And you tuned in to Morning Edition on KASU Jonesboro. It's 8:19. Good morning, I'm Mark Smith. Joining me by phone this morning is Arkansas 1st District Representative Rick Crawford.
Hey, Mark, how are you?
Doing well. Here in Washington, though, I understand we're playing a bit of dueling budgets. We got the Paul Ryan budget in the House versus the Patty Murray budget in the Senate. These are opposing party proposals. What are they mainly aimed at? Are they just offering budget proposals, or is it keeping the government running or fixing the sequester or both or neither or what?
Well, I think it kind of all of that is they're all components of what's going on here with respect to the budget. But, obviously the House version is going to be considerably different than the Senate version.
Right.
Of course, the president hasn't even submitted a budget yet, so we don't really know where he stands on paper. We know we've heard some of the rhetoric on TV and news coverage and so on. But at any rate, that's where we stand right now as far as the budget goes.
Well, it is kind of an unusual situation in the Senate. I understand that the Senate would propose a budget before the president proposes one.
Yeah, and I don't know if what they're waiting on. I don't know why if the president is going to look at both budgets and then try to submit one that sort of meets in the middle. I kind of doubt it. Although he has been kind of on a goodwill tour, if you will, trying to reach out to today. He'll come to Republican conference and meet with us, and then he'll go over to the Senate, I believe, tomorrow and meet with Republican conference there. So. For the first time in his tenure, he's actually coming down here to the Hill. But I don't know, I don't really know what all that means. Maybe largely political theater. I don't know.
Well, I know we've got to pass something to keep the budget running past March 27th, as I understand it, which is the next crisis in what seems to be our ongoing cycle of budget crises.
Well, this budget is a 2014 budget. What we did last week was the continuing resolution to fund the government for the balance of this fiscal year. So
okay.
We passed the CR out of the House. So what we're talking about now is fiscal year 2014 and what the blueprint is going forward, and that's what these budgets are about.
As this continuing resolution, you said you passed it out of the House. What about the Senate?
Well, the Senate has to do the same. I don't know if they've passed. They have not passed theirs yet.
Okay.
And so we're kind of waiting on that. Hopefully they'll do it. As you indicated, they have till March 27th. That seems a fairly simple operation to me. I mean, we certainly want to avoid a government shutdown. And the House passing the CR, certainly we've done our part to make sure that we do avoid a government shutdown.
Now, this sequestration was designed to be so egregious that it would force the parties to work together to reach a budget deal in order to prevent these automatic across-the-board cuts from happening. But, of course, as we know, no deal was reached, and the automatic cuts have kicked in. Thinking locally here in Northeast Arkansas, what's the impact? Are we feeling this yet?
Well, fortunately, we are, and it is all entirely avoidable. We received a copy of an internal USDA email from a fairly high-ranking individual. In fact, his name is Charles Brown. He's the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service Eastern Regional Director, and he was asking for his superiors about what flexibility he had in trimming his program's budget in light of the sequester. And the response from the Obama administration was very clear. I have it in front of me, and I'm going to read this quote. It says, and I quote, "We've gone on record with a notification to Congress and whoever else that APHIS would eliminate assistance to producers in 24 states in managing wildlife damage to the aquaculture industry unless they provide funding to cover the cost." So he goes on to say, "It is our opinion that however you manage that reduction, you need to make sure you are not contradicting what we said the impact would be," end quote. So it's obvious that upper management in these agencies have been given their directives that they want to make sure that the sequester does all the damage that they said it would, and that's purely political. And when you have middle management, people that know the folks and work with the folks on the ground, and you see this type of directive coming from the highest levels, you know, it's painfully obvious that what they're interested in is scoring political points so that they can point the finger and say, see, I told you it was going to be bad. When what we really see is managers, you know, in the states and lower levels that say, hey, we can implement these cuts responsibly and do as little damage as possible. Let's go ahead and do it. But they're not given the green light to do that because the administration wants it to be as painful as possible so that, you know, it supports their argument. When, in fact, the sequester was the president's idea in the first place.
So you're saying there are ways to manage the sequester cuts in a way that's less painful.
Absolutely, and everybody in these agencies knows it. And unfortunately, they're being directed by higher-ups, administration appointees, to do it in accordance with the plan from the White House that suggests that, you know, it's going to be painful on everybody and it's going to inflict a lot of damage. Well, let's not do anything to mitigate that damage. Let's go on ahead and make sure that it inflicts as much damage as possible and creates as much pain for as many people as possible. So we can sit back and say, see, I told you so. And that's unfortunate that we have a leader in the White House that has that type of view, but this is the evidence of it.
Well, of course, the sequester itself, though, not in any way to excuse or defend what the administration may be doing, but the sequester itself is a politicized situation. It's, you know, the fact that the parties weren't able to prevent it. Isn't each party blaming each other for the situation? Aren't you and other Republicans also politicizing the situation?
Well, let me say this. You know, the House of Representatives has twice passed measures to avert the sequester. And we weren't saying that we were trying to get out of the deal. What we were saying was that, look, we're going to hit the number, and we understand that we need to cut spending. I think everybody in America understands that we need to cut spending. But we arrived at a figure that was manageable. We hit the number, and we did it in a responsible way. We did it twice. The Senate had no interest in taking up those bills, and the president would likely not have signed it if they had passed them. So what that indicates is that we have those here in Washington that would rather score political points and do damage while they're scoring political points than they would actually address the problem. Now, I mean, and then we saw, you know, political examples that I can give you are, for example, the White House tours were canceled. Now, that's ridiculous. Those are self-guided tours. All you're asking is for, you know, security screening to get into the White House. So, no, we're going to discontinue those. That was an overt political move to try and hurt people and make a statement about how bad the sequester would be. Totally unnecessary. In contrast, the Capitol is still open and we're still conducting tours. Heck, my office conducts tours daily and, you know, numerous tours every day. The Capitol is still open. We're welcoming people. These are guided tours, by the way. Mm-hmm. And we're welcoming American citizens to come and take part in the American experience. The White House tour is part of that American experience, but they would rather keep people out under the auspices of tightening their belts. There are so many other more prudent ways to tighten your belt than closing your doors to the people who pay your salary.
Well, I remember at one time Speaker Boehner and President Obama had sat down and negotiated an agreement among themselves, but then Mr. Boehner, as I remember, could not get his colleagues in the House to support it.
Well, I mean, that's always going to be the case, that we have differences of opinion. And I'm not sure, but I think you're referring to Plan B that was in the latter part of last year that didn't make it to the floor, and that's unfortunate. And you know, that's largely attributable to some of the operations and the activities of third-party groups, you know, off the Hill that, you know, make their presence known in a variety of ways. But the point is this, that we did two times since August of 2011 pass bills that would have implemented these cuts in a responsible way, not getting around the dollar figure that was prescribed by sequester, but engaging in a more responsible approach to how we arrive at that number. And, you know, our colleagues on the Senate side had no interest in taking that to the president.
What about the issue of closing tax loopholes? I've heard several Republicans talk about over the past year that they believe in closing tax loopholes, but it seems like if there's a proposal to do that, it's then seen as a tax increase and rejected.
Well, here's the thing. I don't think anybody in Washington can say that they're not interested in trying to reform the tax code. But, you know, look, we gave in to the president as a body. The House of Representatives said, okay, we're going to give you the tax increase that you've been asking for on folks that that make more than $200,000. He got that revenue. Okay, so he's still talking about revenue. And I'll tell you this, if he were talking about revenue in the context of paying down debt, I think you'd have a lot more people willing to listen. But he's not. He's talking about revenue in the context of increasing government spending and growing government, which we've seen time and time again exacerbates the problem. It doesn't help. And so we have a fundamental difference of opinion on how we grow the economy, and he wants to grow the government. He thinks that's the way to help the economy. We think empowering the private sector is the more efficient and the most prudent and the most in keeping with our tenets of our country than to get the government so big that it's the single biggest employer in the country. That's not what we want to see. We want to see a thriving private sector that helps create jobs and helps people realize their own goals and their own aspirations on their own terms and not prescribed by the government.
How do we come to an agreement about what to cut? What are the responsible things that can be cut?
Well, for one thing, I think you have to show some deference to the committees of authority. You know, that's our responsibility, and I'll give you this as an example. You know, in coming up with those two bills that were the alternative to the sequester, each committee was charged with the responsibility of implementing those cuts, on a pro rata portion based on their agencies under their purview, and the Ag Committee had to hit a number. Well, we were able to hit our number by, and I've talked to you about this before, by some pretty responsible reforms in nutrition. And we closed some loopholes in the nutrition program that were being exploited to the tune of billions of dollars. And so, you know, when you talk about trying to close loopholes, you know, the president's focused on closing tax loopholes, but he doesn't want to talk about how do we close loopholes that are being exploited by people who just want to take advantage of these nutrition programs. Here's the problem with that. When you have these nutrition programs that are grossly exploited, what you really do is you compromise the resources that are allocated for folks who really need it. So the folks who really need the help are having essentially food taken out of their mouths by people who just want to take advantage of the system. So we went through there and did a lot of oversight hearings and some working with the agency to determine where the exploitation was coming from, what loopholes needed to be closed, dealing with categorical eligibility, dealing with the certification. If you receive a LIHEAP check, a nominal check, even in $25, you're automatically eligible for food stamps. And then we see the agency as an administrative directive actively engaged in trying to reach out and expand the base of beneficiaries of food stamps. Look, I mean, college students, they're actively recruiting college students to participate in the food stamp program. Look, I was a college student once, as you were. Part of the college experience is eating, ramen noodles and bologna. That's what you do. And so why are we reaching out to these kids who, in many cases, I'm not trying to be, overly broad here, but, they've got parental support in a lot of cases. They've got other opportunities, so they can get plenty of nutrition. Why do they need to be on food stamps as college students? And, I've got a real problem with that. So we were able to hit $31.5 billion in that budget reconciliation just on ag. So if we can do that in the ag committee and every other committee hits their number, we do it, down at the agency level and allow them to be managers and say, look, we know we're going to ask you to do some cuts, but we're going to trust your judgment on where they need to go rather than, the Office budget and program analysis, or the Office of Budget and Management from the White House telling everybody, here it is, cut, you know, from the top. You know, that's irresponsible.
Well, we are we're running out of time. You talk about your work on the Ag Committee. Tell us about the Farm Bill. Where are we on that?
Well, I think we're going to start to mark up the Farm Bill in the latter part of April. I think the general feeling in the House is that our Farm Bill this year will look an awful lot like it did last year coming out of the House Ag Committee. I do think it's going to go to the floor. I think everybody recognizes that we can't do another extension, that we need a full reauthorization. It'll come to the floor more likely than not under an open rule, in which case we don't know what the Farm Bill will look like when it's finished on the floor. However, we do feel like we have a good shot at reconciling our Farm Bill with the Senate version. The Senate is just going to stand pat on what they turned out last year. They're not making any adjustments, so that's what they're going to submit. And we'll reconcile that and hopefully be able to have the president sign a Farm Bill full reauthorization sometime maybe in the late part of the summer, early fall. But, you know, September 30th, we have to do it before September 30th. So I expect that we will probably quickly mark up our Farm Bill in the House as soon as we start sometime late April. And then let the games begin. We'll send it to the floor and then we'll conference it with the Senate version.
All right. Well, that's about all the time we have today. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you.
Congressman Rick Crawford joins us from his office in Washington. Listening to Morning Edition on KASU.